negotiating team told Press TV that any negotiator should use all sources of power in his hands to strengthen their position facing the other party.
One of the strongest points is the resistance and the position of the resistance in the negotiation or for asking for getting what is right for Lebanon.
The speakers believe that Israeli attempts to drill in disputed waters could escalate the current status quo.
The Lebanese community and the media community is behind the Lebanese negotiation and behind the Lebanese resistance to confirm our right and in our wealth.
Within the presence of the resistance as well as the army of Lebanon and the people who refuse such aggression, because we believe that this act is already an aggression against Lebanon, and we have all the right to give a response to it, whether it is a legal response or any form, diplomatic or political, or any form of response within our power of nation.
We came here, Lebanese government and people and press, to make the line and the point that this is our land and this is our sea and this is our sky.
Israeli caretaker Minister Yair Lapid has told U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein that he wants to make a deal with Lebanon over the disputed waters as soon as possible. This comes a week after Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah said the resistance is ready for military escalation if Western pressure to prevent Lebanon from extracting its resources continues. Hochstein is expected in Beirut later in July.
We are here in Naqoura, the last Lebanese town on Lebanon's south coast. From here, at least three lines have been drawn in efforts to demarcate the maritime borders, all of which remain disputed, and nine both potentially rich in gas and petrol. But Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, says Western pressure has hampered extraction activities. Mariam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
The notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Veretz, meaning peacemaker. It publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old, and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Oles Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Rocelli, an Italian journalist, after he was killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mirotavets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Dianis Bitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, he's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have a right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism.
They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. They basically That's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. So, like the old saying is that the other's one's terrorist is another other one's freedom fighter, and hopefully all sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons, and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
As the United Nations is pushing the warring sites in Yemen to renew the truce, the Sana'a government has set new conditions to accept the extension for a third period of 6 months. The head of Yemen's national negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdel Salam, said the United Nations is now required to ensure the payment of all salaries, which are suspended since 2016.
If the leadership in Sana'a accept the extension of the truce, the commitment under the agreement should be implemented from the first day of the truce. The blockade must be lifted by land, sea and air. All roads must be opened, and the salaries of Yemeni employees must be paid. The oil wells must be preserved, and the suffering of prisoners should be ended. Without this, the truce has no meaning.
Experts say it is likely that Sana'a rejects the terms of the current truce and pushes the United Nations to further ease the suffering of Yemenis by dispersing salaries.
It is clear from the political and military statements of Sana'a that they will not accept the request to extend the ceasefire easily. There are new demands by Sana'a to enter a third period of the agreement. The United Nations must fulfill previous commitments and deal with the new conditions positively. Otherwise, there will be a military escalation.
Yemen's demands come against the backdrop of United Nations' failure to force the Saudi-led coalition to fulfill its commitments under the current agreement that was brokered by the world body in early April.
Disappointing and useless, that's how Yemenis describe the current UN brokered agreement. They say the Yemeni army should be prepared for different scenarios, including military escalation. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Due to their decision to sanction Russia over the unrest in Ukraine, France and the European Union are desperately trying to build energy stocks ahead of this winter. However, a record heat wave has created a surge in energy consumption, and that's prompted the government to informally call for the rationing of electricity. Citizens have been pushed to make an effort by cutting off Wi-Fi, unplugging appliances, and going without air conditioning. Many in poor neighborhoods say they expect their streets to go dark earlier and for their social services to be affected first. The West's sanctions campaign against Russia continues to force the average household into paying a steep price.
It's very difficult to see this crisis getting better by 2023. Finding alternative sources for gas and petrol will cause higher prices. Renewable energy will be more expensive. France isn't a big coal producer. France is already depleting its petrol and gas stocks. So every choice away from Russian energy is going to increase energy prices.
In order to have more control over the national energy grid, this week the government announced that they will totally renationalize the company Electricity of France. The energy giant runs all of the nation's nuclear power plants. Nuclear power provides nearly 70% of France's energy, the most of any country in the world. But a recent series of outages have caused nuclear power output to drop to its lowest level in nearly 30 years. Leaders of French energy corporations recently said that energy cuts are certain for this winter and that prolonged cold spells may threaten social and political cohesion.
The best solution is to negotiate with Russia to end the war in Ukraine. But we also need the leaders of the European Union to stop living in an isolated fishbowl where pushing for more war is a good idea. This energy and economic crisis is affecting all citizens.
A proposal to give the European Union the right to impose mandatory gas rationing across the bloc's 27 member countries was immediately shot down by the nations of Southern Europe this week.
They called it the farthest-reaching power grab by Brussels this year. And it was especially controversial because individual national vetoes were not allowed under an emergency procedure employed by the leaders of the European Union. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
I'm heading with pro-Russian forces to the front line, just outside the city of Donetsk. We move at a fast pace, as there is constant incoming and outgoing at these positions. Suddenly we are told to run as we reach open ground. The pro-Russians had just fired a heavy artillery barrage. The Ukrainians will most likely respond in kind. We reach the trenches. Opposing them is the Ukrainian stronghold of Adievka. For 8 years, the Ukrainians have been digging in, creating a complex network of underground bunkers. It will be one of the greatest challenges for Russia in this war so far. This fighter is an Abkhazi volunteer from the south of Russia. I asked him why he came to fight in Donbass.
It's our common sacred task to stand by Russia. We understand that an unjust war is going on. This territory is Russian land. Unfortunately, NATO and the USA are trying to make use of the collapse of the USSR. And you see the results of this work. Unfortunately, people die in war. And Russians and Ukrainians are fraternal peoples.
Now, about a month ago, I was in a frontline position not far from here, and it was pretty quiet. Now, the situation has changed as the pro-Russian forces here are trying to move forward into different positions. The Russian army is far to the north of here. There's a feeling that before making a full push, they will wait for the Russian army to come down and help to encircle Adievka. But for the moment, they're trying to keep the Ukrainian positions occupied. That's why there's so much incoming and outgoing from this position.
While NATO and Ukraine have been declaring for months that morale is low this side of the battle lines, all the pro-Russian fighters I've spoken to over 2 months here clearly have high morale. They are in no doubt they will take Adievka soon, as well as the rest of Donbass. And they believe they are fighting for a worthy cause.
They know perfectly well Russia doesn't target civilians, so they set up their positions where civilians are. We have sympathy for these civilians, but we will liberate them. And for those who force the Ukrainians to fight, for the Nazis, we do not have any sympathy. The card, as ever, was played by the Americans. It should be realized. Ukraine doesn't need this war. Their minds are not clear. They were left no choice but to fight by NATO.
While Ukraine is putting up a fierce defense in Donbass, the advantage is Russia's, with its overwhelming artillery superiority. As this conflict approaches its sixth month, soldiers are dying for each kilometer of land. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Five rounds of voting by UK Conservative MPs have produced the final two candidates for party leader. It's now down to Tory party members to decide who will be the next leader of not just their own party, but the country too. The finalists, Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, are lining up for their final showdown to become Boris Johnson's successor. The winner set to be announced on September the 5th, following a vote among the 160,000 or so members.
While members have been given a full month to vote, experience from past similar postal ballots suggests that many members will probably decide on who they want to vote for immediately, casting their ballots as soon as they get the chance to do so. So that means that the two candidates will have to rely on a rapid, hard-hitting initial start to their campaign in order to try and grab as many to their side as they possibly can.
The Conservative dogfight has raised concerns within Tory ranks that bitter divides are being exposed to the public, further damaging the party's overall image.
The comments made in the debates were really more personal in nature and really relating to people's performance and particular minutiae of policy. There aren't really substantial differences in the Conservative Party. There may be slight disagreements on, well, you shouldn't have put the taxes up, or you should have originally been a Leaver, but now they're all signed up to taking Britain through the Brexit process, which, contrary to some, is still continuing because there's unfinished business from leaving the European Union. But really the differences are slight and have been somewhat exaggerated.
The two candidates must now travel across the country and tackle questions from members. with the economy in crisis, party reputation on the rocks, and even greater issues with foreign policy, whoever wins will have serious work to do. Robert Carter, London.
They can make people laugh, impersonate voices, or sing. The stage for talents. The 5th International Stage Stars Festival brought together participants from 14 countries, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey, to get on stage and perform in Iran's city of Rafsanjan.
I come from Bangladesh. I have participated in the hosting section. It's an amazing festival for the likes of me who pursue their dreams.
I am participating from Iraq. I'm so glad to have the opportunity to show my talent here in this event.
I have to represent our culture, Indian culture, and when I was in the start in the Tehran, then how I managed to live, because I didn't know the Persian language.
The contest has four categories of singing: stand-up comedy, show hosting, and sound impression. Contestants say this stage provides a shortcut to their success.
I'm so happy to be able to take part in this international talent contest. It provides a great opportunity for stage talents to be seen and shine in their favorite fields.
Stage Stars is a good chance for singers, sound impressionists, and stand-up comedians to be discovered. It's a big leg up for them.
The jury is comprised of top Iranian actors, TV presenters, and voice artists. They say only their real talents will be picked for the top prize.
This is a competition between the professionals of stage performance. There is no chance for a mistake. Each contestant here has a strong background in their expertise, so this stage is not the starting point, but a milestone for their careers.
One interesting part of this festival is the participation of international talents, who are mainly students from other countries who study in Iran. There's a separate competition dedicated for foreign participants.
All of the contestants, even those who come from foreign countries, must perform in Persian. However, organizers plan to include other languages in the upcoming editions of the festival. The top performances from each category will win the golden mic, plus a cash prize. Organizers say this contest seeks to scout for those who really have a knack for stage performance and to bring them under the spotlight. So to those who nab the golden mic here, this stage is a springboard toward their ambitions. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Rafsanjan.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. It's really hot in here, and eating ice cream really hits the spot. Fortunately, I have ice cream in the freezer. Yes. To today, there are different brands of ice creams in the world, which have chain stores in most of the countries, and almost everyone is familiar with their name. It's interesting to know that we, in Iran, have a well-known traditional ice cream name, namely Akbar Mashti ice cream. The delicious ice cream which I'm eating right now is from this brand. It tastes great. This ice cream dates back to nearly 80 years ago. Today we are going to visit Akbar Mashti ice cream shop. Stay with me. Akbar Mashti was the first Iranian who started the business of selling ice cream. His real name was Akbar Jafari Malayeri. He tried several different professions before starting an ice cream shop. At those times, he met a person who had learned about making ice cream in France. Akbar Mashti, along with that man, opened the first ice cream shop in Tehran at Ray Street. The ice cream produced in this shop was completely compatible with the Iranian taste. He used clotted cream, rose water, and saffron for making this particular type of ice cream. In those days that refrigerator was not widely used, people used to dig deep holes in the earth, then poured ice gained from mountains in these holes and covered them. In the time of need through the ice, in the hot seasons, they took ice from the holes. Akbar Mashti used to keep his ice cream cold in proximity of the ice which was gained in this way. Akbar Mashti died at 97. His stepson, called Mohammad Malayeri, inherited his ice cream shop, who, by launching another branch of Akbar Mashti ice cream shop at Tajrish Square in Tehran, has enlivened the name of this old Iranian ice cream brand. I am now at Tajrish Square, an old neighborhood located in northern Tehran. People are standing in a queue to buy ice cream. Of course, Akbar Mashti ice cream. I'll stand in the queue in order to buy some ice cream. Then I'll talk to you about the vibes of this well-known ice cream shop. I am now inside Akbar Mashti ice cream shop. The kind owner of this shop, Mr. Mohammad Malayeri, gave me the permission to take a close look at the corners of this shop. Well, there are pieces of old newspapers and magazines on the walls. These papers have published interesting information about this ice cream shop. This part of the shop is an attractive location for the customers who have heard about the reputation of Akbar Mashti ice cream. On this wall, there is the picture of Mohammad Malayeri, known as Amir Mashti, standing beside Akbar Mashti. And this is an amazing picture of Amir Mashti wearing academic dress. He has majored in law. He told me that one night he had a dream about his uncle who had advised him to continue the profession of making and selling ice cream and enliven the name of Akbar Mashti. Well, I'll buy some ice cream for myself And a lot more for my grandma, because she loves Akbarmashti ice cream. And who doesn't like such a delicious, fragrant saffron ice cream?
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
While the world continues to condemn Russia's special military operation against Ukraine, Russia provides its reasons for continuing that operation. In the latest, Russia has said that it had hit a Ukrainian warship and a weapons store in Odessa with its high-precision missiles. Two attacks have taken place in Odessa by Russia. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the developments coming out of this conflict, which consists of continuing energy shortages for EU countries, and whether the U.S. provocative moves can prove to be one too many for Russia to counter-react with what the former Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev once said the U.S. may receive a Judgment Day response. Our guests for this edition of the Spotlight are Ray McGovern joins us. He's a former CIA analyst who joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Also joining us is Jeff Brown, radio host and journalist who joins us from Normandy. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me first start with you, Ray McGovern, if I may. We're looking first at this incident that has happened twice in the port city of Odessa, where you have Russian, after signing that grain deal for wheat, et cetera, to target it. But it has said that the missiles did not hit the port's grain storage in the first incident and did not cause significant damage, and the other two actually have targeted what Russia has said is an area that held some U.S. weapons. Russia has its reasons. How do you see this strike by Russia, of which it's being blamed for now by the entire world, practically?
Well, it's very hard to know. Russia does have its reasons. The question is whether those were ammo dumps and supplies and so forth. And we will not know that because we have no journalists worth the name in that part of Ukraine. There's a backstory to this grain deal, and that is that even though Russia has been blamed for preventing the export of grain, it was the mines that Ukraine laid in the access to Odessa that really made it impossible for the grain ships to be insured on the one hand, and then to go get the grain and bring it out. That has been resolved now. There's a channel that has been cleared of mines. The Russian foreign minister worked this out with the UN Secretary General 2 weeks ago, okay? Why doesn't the UN Secretary General acknowledge that? Well, We all know why. So the deal is good, but it could have been done weeks ago if there was an agreement by the Ukrainians to clear the mines that they had laid in the approaches to Odessa.
Okay, let's take a look at the military aspect of this war, Jeff Brown, if we may, in terms of how things stand when you compare the Russian army versus the Ukrainian army, based on just the latest, just a few aspects of the numbers. The Russian military, 771,000 active military personnel versus Ukraine's roughly 200,000. These are rough numbers. Russia's total tanks, 20,000. A little bit more than that, 20,050 versus 2,045 for the Ukrainian side. This is skewed heavily in favor of Russia to the point where it's kind of hard to really imagine Ukraine catching up when you have these kinds of numbers in favor of Russia. What kind of strategy could there then be in the Ukrainian officials' minds to continue this war?
The president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, recently said in a groundbreaking speech, and I wish we could talk about it, but we don't. This is not the time to do it. But he said that that NATO wants to defeat Russia, and he said, "Okay, go ahead and try. We haven't even really started." So all of this propaganda from the West about the Russians, they can't move and they can't advance and they, et cetera. They are using a little finger's worth of their military might. The U.S. and NATO thought that Russia was going to run out of high-precision missiles in 2 weeks. The Russians learned in World War II that you never run out of ammunition, and they never did, and they're not going to run out of ammunition now. This is not about Ukraine. This is about the West trying to save Western imperialism, global capitalism. This is way, way beyond Ukraine now. And it's pretty clear to me that Russia, they're taking their sweet time. The West thought that it was going to deplete Russian resources. Russia is basically toying with the West like like a cat and a mouse. And they are the Russians are now depleting Western resources. And Shoigu, the Minister of Defense, was just in Donbass last week and said, time to move further west and beyond Donbass to get Ukrainians away from the Donbass so that their missiles can quit slaughtering innocent victims. Russia has already won, NATO has already lost, and Russia is going to bleed NATO dry until it has no more ammunition left.
Okay, well, that puts another aspect to this, Ray McGovern, if you agree, because I was going to ask you about the fact that, what kind of goals would Russia have? They set out wanting that eastern part, but as our guests there indicated, their aspirations are not beyond that. But he put a twist in there, if I may call it that, that it wants to deplete the West, in particular the U.S., and then in turn, by default almost, EU countries' resources. Is that what Russia now intends to do, or maybe it has had that plan way before?
Well, there are three very important things that happened this past week, and I want to name them before we run out of time. One was the Iranian statement that they fully support Russia and its aims in Ukraine. Two was the Chinese foreign ministry statement saying the same thing. Real big events. The third one plays into what's going on in the ground. Now, on the same day, oddly enough, Foreign Secretary Sergei Lavrov from Russia said, we're going to expand our aims. We said we'd settle for Donetsk and Lugansk. No. We've got Zaporozhye, we've got other places farther to the west, and we're going to move ahead. And the reason we're going to move ahead and change our original designs or aims is because of the presence of HIMARS. Now, he singled out this rocket system by mentioning HIMARS. Now, here's the crux here. What's HIMARS? Well, that's a rocket system that has a range of about 50 miles. That's dangerous. Now, why did he mention that? Because the U.S. is giving HIMARS to the Ukrainians, and at the same time, on the same day, the Defense Secretary of the United States said, and I quote, "When I heard the news that Russia was expanding its aims in Ukraine, I thought, well, I'll bet the Ukrainian leadership is really happy about how effective our HIMARS are and that they know how to use them." Now, nobody has put two and two together. In other words,
you can do it HIMARS,
Lavrov was saying, is occasioning an expansion of Russian aims, and the Defense Secretary of the United States doesn't seem to realize the implications of this. He's more engaged in a rhetorical system as how good the Ukrainian leadership might feel. My friends who know a lot about military affairs say that HIMARS is no magic bullet. It's not going to change much, and it will encourage the Russians to go farther than I believe they intended to.
Well, yeah, HIMARS, I'm glad you explained that, Ray McGovern. Another thing that it does have, from what we understand here, is that it is, I think each has six GPS radars. It's very precision-guided in that respect. So Russia, in part, did have a reaction in terms of what you mentioned about Lavrov. Now, one of the things that maybe, Jeff Brown, maybe points to the fact that the U.S. and NATO together want this war to continue is perhaps the piece of news that came out. This was, at this point, a couple weeks old, how British forces have begun training Ukrainian soldiers to the tune of 10,000 of them in order to make sure that they will get the special military training, which obviously involves using the equipment that they have no idea how to use. Do you think, and that's going to take time, I'm guessing, when you train that many. Is that one of the reasons, perhaps, why the U.S. and NATO member countries want this war to continue at this point? to give them the a chance of trying to defeat Russia?
You're asking me?
Yes, yes. Jeff Brown, go ahead.
Well, NATO must be absolutely delusional to think that they're going to win this war. And it's, they think they're buying time. I think it's the Russians that are buying time, and they can train 100,000 people in London, and it's not going to change the outcome of what's going to happen in Ukraine. The Russians have applied a tiny percentage of their capability. They could bomb the Ministry of Defense and the nerve center of the Ukrainian army in Kiev with their precision missiles and hurt almost no one. They haven't even begun to really stretch things out here. And with Shoigu and, as Ray mentioned, Lavrov, you know, talking about moving further west. I mean, between all of us, I think in 5 years, Russia's going to have elite tank divisions on the borders with Romania, Hungary, Slovakia, and Poland. They're going to end up with the entire Ukrainian landmass, because the West is simply not going to stop trying to destroy Russia, failing the entire way. And the only way to stop it is to get to the EU border. And I think that's what will happen in the next 5 years. I think it's just a matter, it's just an eventuality, because the West will not stop.
Well, Ray McGovern, let me see what you think about what the former Medvedev has said in terms of the possibility of Crimea being attacked with these HIMARS weapons, because that's one of the things that was mentioned by Zelensky, of which he said that will ignite Judgment Day response. Judgment Day will come very fast and hard. It will be very difficult to hide. Can you please tell us what he means by Judgment Day?
Well, Medvedev has been the bad cop over the last several months. In other words, he's been given the task to issue pointed warnings. Now, as I mentioned, the HIMARS, for example, have a range of 50 miles. Now, you put them somewhere near Crimea, and they can do a lot of damage. They can't reach that bridge just yet unless they, well, no, I don't think they can have the range for that. But there are other rocket systems that the U.S. could provide. I'm not looking at a horizon of 5 years. I can't think in those terms. I'm thinking of a horizon of several months, and the key juncture is the U.S. midterm elections. By November, when the elections take place, the West is going to be losing profoundly. And there will be great pressure on Biden and his military to do something even worse than HIMARS. And that concerns me greatly, because if they escalate all the way to more advanced systems, which can go 200 miles, then Russia itself and that bridge that connects Russia with Crimea are in jeopardy. So this escalation, which I believe really started just this week on the 20th, when Lavrov said, "We're going farther," and the Defense Secretary of the United States said, "Well, you know, well, see, the Ukrainians will be very happy to hear that, because our weapons are working, and that's why they're going farther." Well, doesn't he? How is he advising the American president? Is he telling Mr. Biden, hey, we got to be prepared for some really bad results here when they go farther west? They're going to take Odessa. They may go as far as Moldova. And, you know, this is a real problem. It's not a rhetorical exercise. Does he tell Biden that? I'm not sure he has the brains to do that. He's no smarter than Blinken, the Secretary of State. And that's an invidious comparison.
Well, you have other statements made. For example, Jeff Brown, this question for you, where Zelensky has promised Ukraine will not give up as the Russian invasion at this point is entering the 6 months. On the same day, which is today, you had the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine say, Washington will support Kiev for as long as it takes. So we're trying to figure out a timeline. Ray McGovern says a couple of months. I think you made a reference, Jeff Brown, to years. Do you really think it will take years?
Well, I said 5 years that the map will be changed in 5 years, and Ukraine will be reintegrated into the Russian Federation, into the motherland where Ukraine was for centuries. And in fact, Russian Orthodox Christianity began in Crimea. So there's a lot of history with Russia there. I just don't see any other choice for Russia than to just keep pushing. I mean, they could do what the United States does, and flatten everybody and kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people, like they did in Iraq and Libya and what they're doing in Syria, et cetera. But they're trying to save civilian lives. They're trying to save civilian infrastructure. And since the Ukrainian Nazis put all of their personnel and equipment in churches and hospitals and apartment blocks and other sensitive sites, it really frustrates the Russians. They could roll to Lviv in a month or two if they wanted to wage war like the United States typically does, which is no regard for civilian life and no regard for for infrastructure. So I think Russia is thinking in years. I think they think that they know they are going to deplete NATO's weaponry. There's even Raytheon and the other manufacturers are saying it's going to take them 3, 4, 5 years to replace what's already been sent to Ukraine. How are they going to get all that back? And as far as Zelensky is concerned, he and his mafia crony that manipulates him like a puppet, they're making billions off of this thing. They are making billions, raking money off of all of these arms and stuff coming into the country. So he loves what's going on, because he's becoming even a bigger billionaire than he already is, and his mafia boss, who works with him. So that's my assessment. I really hope Russia does roll all the way to the border of Poland, and because that's what it's going to take to bring Western Empire to its knees.
Mm-hmm. Ray McGovern, you have something to say, it seems like. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd just like to comment on that and to warn that there could be what Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, warned just this week, a false flag, an unanticipated event, the kind of thing that changed things dramatically. I have in mind Zaporozhye, where there are many nuclear structures there. The Ukrainian Nazis are crazy. It is not beyond their capability or their intention, in my view, to strike one of those nuclear sites, to blame it on the Russians, and everything changes, because now the Russians have attacked the nuclear facilities in Ukraine, and there are many of them. So I just warn that things could change rapidly, and Lavrov himself is warning in a very pointed way about these staged, he calls them, staged events to prevent the inexorable advance of the Russian army.
So what kind of response will we get, supposedly, if what you're speculating happens?
Well, that's just it. I have no confidence that Biden is up to responding to this. As a matter of fact, Lavrov himself has said in a recent interview, Biden is not in charge. Who's doing this are the top of the State Department and one or two people in the White House. They have ample proof of that, because Biden has gone back on some of his promises, almost certainly due to pressure from the military-industrial complex, as well as State Department and one or two in the White House. So they have no confidence in Biden, neither do I. And this, This raises a really explosive situation if a unplanned or a false flag attack happens. And as I say, it doesn't have to be a nuclear thing. It could be all kinds of other things like chemical attacks, such as the ones that were staged in Syria.
Indeed. Well, there was another explosion that it kind of has been swept under the rug, but it is pretty noteworthy, and that is the treason that was noted inside the Ukrainian government, where President Volodymyr Zelensky dismissed the security chief and also the prosecutor general, and he said that there are roughly around 650 cases involving officials that are suspected of treason, aiding Russia. Now, how big a deal is that, Jeff Brown?
You know, Zelensky, it's a sad commentary that this Nazi sympathizer is the most powerful leader in the Western world right now. It's tragic. And who knows? You know, there's so much corruption. There is so much money, you know, money laundering going on in Ukraine. Ukraine is the biggest washing machine for the West for money laundering. It could be he just needs to, you know, get some guys out who are not, you know, cooperating with him and putting in some of his cronies. I have no idea. And it's also, you know, optics to look good, like he's trying to save Ukraine. So I really can't say, and who knows. Whether they even left or not, it may have just been a psychological operation that he asked these
okay.
guys to leave.
Let me cut you and give Ray McGovern a chance, and you could respond. And with that, that'll be the last question. Ray McGovern, go ahead.
I could easily catch this in terms of a staged event. Now, what happened was real. Okay, Lavrov himself, in his major statement this week, talked about Zelensky or whoever comes in to replace him, okay? Gratuitous remark. There's going to be someone coming in to replace him, and you know the Russians are afraid of being blamed for that. They've avoided that so far, and Zelensky, please remember, is not his own man. He's pulled by strings in Washington and in Brussels, and also by the Azov people, the Nazis, against whom he has to be very, very afraid, because he's vulnerable from both sides, the right and the left.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst. Jeff Brown, thank you so much, radio host and journalist. And with that, we come to an end for this.